Good morning. You've arrived at Listen Local, the bi-weekly webcast brought to you by your neighborhood news source, Mission Local. Today we're going to talk about a couple of things happening in the neighborhood that are of interest to most of our readers. One of them is something that is coming up at the Planning Commission in 2 weeks called the Affordable Housing Density Bonus Program. There's similar programs around the state and around the country, and this one is another attempt by the city to try and figure out how to build the affordable housing that San Francisco needs. But like any other project regarding affordable housing, this project as well is met with some opposition. People don't think that this is the way to go, or they're worried that it'll have unintended consequences. So we'll talk about that. And we're also going to discuss police shootings and violence at the hands of officers, which has garnered quite a bit of attention in protests and also in light of Martin Luther King Jr. Day on Monday. And this week, the Rules Committee is also going to talk about the use of force by police officers and how that can be handled and how excessive force incidents can be prevented in the future. Both of these topics, affordable housing density bonus program and the use of force by law enforcement officers, are going to be discussed at meetings today. So keep your eyes peeled for coverage of those in Mission Local going forward. Here with me today are Laura Waxman and Joe Ravano-Barros, our reporters. Hey, guys.
Good morning.
Hey, how's it going?
This is actually a pre-recorded program, so we're totally lying to you about the time of day. But in any case, let's jump right in and talk about the Affordable Housing Density Bonus Program, which is a mouthful no matter which way you slice it. It kind of doesn't matter whether you abbreviate it or just say it out loud. But either way, the Affordable Housing Density Program, whatever you want to call it, the idea, Joe, you're the expert sort of among us on this, is to allow folks to add stories to their developments or existing buildings if part of a significant chunk of what they're adding is affordable housing in an effort to convince people to produce more affordable housing. Is that about right?
Yeah, so developers would be able to add two stories to their buildings if 30% of their total unit count were affordable housing, which means housing available to people making up to 150% area median income, so the median income for San Francisco, which is pretty high right now. And there's not a lot of contention per se on that. The contention really comes in with, where is this housing going to be built? There was a lot of concern that to build anything up, you would really have to demolish an existing building, and that would mean a tenant would be, in effect, permanently displaced. So even regardless of whether you're demolishing rent-controlled units, which has just been excluded from the proposal by the planning department, it still means that someone is going to be leaving town, and probably permanently.
Okay, so hold on. So let's back up a second for people who are maybe not paying attention to every little twist and detail of the city's planning code. The idea is that you can build more if more of it is affordable. And you can do that even on lots where housing already exists, right?
Yeah, so you would be able to, but to do that effectively, you have to demolish the existing building to build up.
Okay, so there, I think that is sort of the first rub. That's one of the main concerns that housing activists, housing rights activists have had, is that if you demolish a building, no matter how much affordable housing you build in its place, you're going to effectively create people who need affordable housing and need a place to live because the people who lived there beforehand are now getting kicked out. And then you mentioned something about a certain exception that has just been added.
Yeah, so the first part you said is right. I mean, we see this even in the Mission with fires when people are displaced for a year or two just to get the building back up and running. It really means that they move to Oakland or, you know, Antioch, wherever, and they stay there permanently because they make new lives. This would be the same thing. To build a unit up, you need to change what the building is made of from wood to steel, and that means demolishing the current building and displacing tenants. The exception that was carved out was for rent-controlled units, but it still means that a lot of housing would be eligible for this bonus program, this density bonus, and that means that buildings could be torn down and tenants could be displaced.
Mm-hmm. Is there any plan as what's going to happen with these tenants who are being displaced if this actually passes?
You know, I think there's always talk of things that can be done to tenants, trying to find them new units in the city, help them with relocation costs. But the reality is that the only affordable rent is going to be outside of San Francisco for many of these tenants. And that just means new lives. I don't think you can get around the issue that to build up in the city in general, you have to tear down existing buildings, and that means displacing tenants permanently. So that's just a deal. If you want to make San Francisco a higher city, you're going to have to live with displacing tenants permanently.
Wow. Okay. Well, there's an ultimatum. this is why we have to be fair here. There's a lot of controversy over this just from people who don't want tall buildings because of the aesthetic. So that's, I think maybe we can say that's one group or one source of opposition. And then the source of opposition that we're focusing on, because it's something that we see, like you said, with fires and other displacements that we report on, is, if you build something in the place of where there used to be housing, even if you're building more housing, they're going to end up kicked out.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I reported on a community meeting a couple of weeks ago that got really heated, and one of the things I was most surprised by was that people were opposed to the building just on the height alone because of arguments like wind tunnels, and it just doesn't match the aesthetic of the neighborhood. And, you know, fair enough that, you know, if you live in a Victorian neighborhood, you want to keep those really historic Victorians. I think that there's a fair argument to be made there. But to be opposed to a development on Mission Street, where there are already a lot of pretty tall 3 to 4 story buildings, and this would just be 6 stories just on height alone for 100% affordable housing, is kind of a bit much to me.
Wait, this meeting that you went to was about 100%.
Yeah, so it's not the same as this density bonus project. But there are people in the city that are opposed to these things just because of how tall it would make the city. And, you know, I think that's a bit of a weird argument to make when we have this affordability crisis and people really don't have places to live.
Okay, so we could get into the leaves here, into the woods here, arguing about affordability and how to achieve that. On one hand, you're saying, you know, if you want higher density and taller buildings, you need to accept that some people will be displaced. On the other hand, sounds like you and others would say, if you want an affordable city, you're going to have to deal with it being taller and denser. Alternatively, if you're displacing people for the sake of a denser, more affordable city, then isn't that sort of counterproductive? Because then you're creating that demand for affordable units that the people used to live in before, but you destroyed them.
Yeah, I mean, so I'm not saying that this parcel that I was talking about was on a so-called soft site, which means that there would be no tenants displaced. It's either a parking lot or a commercial site. I think it would be crazy to oppose higher developments on sites where no one is being displaced. If there are people being displaced, that's a different question. Mm-hmm. And whether there's a trade-off there about, like, say you build a 10-story building and displace 10 people, but in the future you'll have, you know, 150 people moving in. Maybe that's worth it, maybe not. That's a different argument.
But that's also a question, to some extent, of who makes that decision. I mean, it's not like they're going out to these building sites and being like, hey, would you move out? Would you trade your spot in this neighborhood for the greater good, essentially?
Yeah, I mean, public policy is not very democratic at the planning level, at least.
Yeah. Well, I mean, here it kind of is, because you have all these people voicing their opinions at planning commission meetings, where ultimately decisions are made. But you also, I want to talk a little bit more about the soft sites idea. There's a map going around, I think, of all the areas that would be affected by this affordable housing density bonus program. So, like, it basically outlines long swaths that go along Geary Street, and I think Irving also. And then you can see a couple of corridors in there that look like Mission Valencia Dolores, a couple of spots along those sites. And so while I think the intention of this project is to make the shortest, least dense parts of the city denser and taller, you know, that's not the only place that it officially affects, right?
Yeah, and I think mostly in the Mission District, it'll actually be on South Van Ness, which has a lot of... So soft sites are things like gas stations, parking lots. South Van Ness has dozens of these. And I think that's what is being identified by the planning department as potentially you know, you could put, why not put a 5-story building there? It, if it's a parking lot, surely we could use more housing there instead of just a living space for cars, right?
Yeah, I just talked to somebody today who is a business owner and is worried about parking. Not because she just has an interest in parking and that's sort of where it ends, but because parking in this part of town is particularly stressful and difficult. And she was saying, if you get a parking ticket for $100, that's the entirety of your day's profits from that business. So, I mean, like, I think sometimes parking is written off, especially by people like me who don't drive cars, as a sort of like silly luxury concern. But like, it really does worry people. I mean, is it fair to say that if you have a parking lot that you must build on top of it?
No, I guess not. But I think that if we're really planning for a future city here, what we need is housing and not parking. And even the taking away parking not only would allow more housing, you know, to be built, it would also incentivize the city as a whole to move towards a transit-rich policy. I mean, if you live in a city, I'm sorry, in the future, you're just not probably going to be able to have a car, or you're going to have to find ways to balance that between taking bikes, taking public transit. I think that, yeah, as a general policy goal, I wouldn't prioritize parking. But also, I mean, I drive cars. I park a lot. I hate it when I can't find parking. I totally sympathize.
Yeah, to an extent. Yeah. So apart from, you know, where geographically this map says that there could be some changes under the affordable housing density bonus program. I keep hearing this number that there's only about 240 sites citywide that could actually be affected, or that are likely to be affected. Are those 240 sites soft sites, or are those 240 sites that would be affected by the program?
Yeah, so the planning department identified technically 30,000 sites that are eligible. But you're right, they also identified 240 parcels. I believe they're all soft sites that would probably be developed under the program. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure if there's a total unit count on what that would give you, but it's not obviously a lot, or it's not game-changing. I mean, this is just, at the end of the day, one tool in a toolbox.
Yeah, aren't we looking at an end goal of like 30,000 units in the next 10 years or something like that?
By 2020, so in the next 4 years.
Ooh, that's fast.
I believe, yeah. That's, yeah, Mayor Ed Lee's goal.
Right.
And so this is, maybe will help that, but it's definitely not a game-changing thing when you need probably hundreds of thousands of units or some radical change in demographics.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've heard it said before that the space where San Francisco, the space that San Francisco has to build on, since it doesn't have space on the ground, is in the air. And so the only place to build is up. And that could be on top of lots in residential areas, or, you know, sort of more quaint commercial corridors. Or it could be even on top of like BART stations, or on top of parking lots or abandoned gas stations or what have you.
Yeah, I mean, I was just downtown today near the Central Subway, which is being built. And apparently they're going to have affordable housing above that, right next to the Community Housing Organization, the Council of Community Housing Organizations building. So there is already that happening, housing on top of transit corridors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it strikes me as a good idea. And it does seem like an innovative idea, this density bonus program, because it doesn't rely on the city to build stuff. It relies on the city to sort of change its approach to shaping the city, you know, which might be totally unpopular because people don't want their neighborhoods to be reshaped. But in terms of figuring out the best way to utilize city resources, I mean, this essentially almost doesn't utilize city resources, right? In terms of financials.
Yeah, but that's also, I think, the problem is that it relies on developers to do this on their own, which means that they're probably at the end of the day doing it because they're getting a cut. So I'm troubled by that.
Okay. Like,
there's no reason
no
why
charitable
the market,
developers.
Yeah, the market does not do things because it's good for other people. It does things because it's good for the bottom line. Mm-hmm. And what a lot of, like, for instance, one of the other things that people are saying is that you can, if you were to be able to count, so if you were to be able to build, like, count existing below market rate units towards your end goal of 30% affordable housing, then effectively you're getting two extra stories for really not building that many more affordable units, because mm-hmm. you're already counting the ones that exist.
Right.
But even if you don't count the ones that exist and you do build, like, say, 30% new units, because they're affordable to people up to 150% AMI, that's actually quite a bit of money for a developer to get from rents.
Mm-hmm.
So he's not really, it's not that big of a sacrifice. I mean, I'm sure they're going to tell you that this is the most we can do. But at the end of the day, they have tenants that are giving them pretty decent rents, and they're going to be able to meet their bottom line through this program, which means that it's probably not strong enough.
Okay. I guess you could put it that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. We should probably move on to our second topic of the afternoon. But before we do that, I want to plug very quickly the meeting this evening. There is an informational meeting about the Affordable Housing Density Bonus Program. I'm having a really hard time with that phrase. About this program in District 8. It's meant for District 8, but I think District 9 residents, if you're into it, you can go too.
Yeah, there's no District 9 meeting, so this is probably your only chance to get your voices heard. I think it's at 725 Diamond Street from 6 to 8 p.m. So
and
get out there. And
we will post that in the description of this podcast as well, in case you want to go. Okay, that being said, I think we should talk also about the other major thing happening this week, sort of this whole week. I mean, we've seen protests about police brutality and police shootings throughout the Martin Luther King Jr. Day weekend and on MLK Day itself. I'm sure most of you know that protesters blocked the Bay Bridge. The entire westbound side was completely blocked by protesters. In this case, I think their main point of advocacy was for Black health, but as always, I think the overall message of Black Lives Matter and ending violence at the hands of police was sort of the main driving force. And on Monday also, the activists and organizers and community members who produced a half-hour film about the case of Alex Nieto, who was shot by police in March of 2014. They released that entire video for free on Monday in the spirit of MLK Day, and also ahead of the civil trial date, which is March 1st, or there's rumors that it's trying to that the city is trying to delay it. So sometime at the beginning of March, that trial will begin, and I think that the activists are hoping that everybody watches that film in advance of that, because it sort of does challenge the official narrative about what happened that day in 2014. So Laura,
hello,
other Laura, you went to a march, a sort of joint march between Mission activists and Bayview activists, because the causes have sort of aligned here, right? So what are we seeing? What's the latest on police shootings here in sentiment?
Well, that particular event was a night march, and it was really interesting because supporters of, you know, Alex Nieto and the Justice for Alex Nieto Coalition met at Bernal Hill. That was the spot where Alex Nieto was shot. And they met there. His parents were there. You know, activists have been really, you know, active in the cause. And they marched down Bernal Hill into the Bayview, where they were met at the Bayview Police Station by protesters marching for Mario Woods, who was shot in 2015, December, by police as well. And I thought it was really powerful. You know, I was there the whole time. It started raining, and the protesters were just there on the streets. There was a heavy police presence, and it was really interesting just to see these two communities align. One of the activists who was marching with us told me that, you know, the Bayview always had the Mission's back, and the Mission always had the Bayview's back.
Mm-hmm.
But now it's especially important to kind of show that alliance
mm-hmm.
in public. And you're right, you know, they are struggling with the same issues. You know, we've seen this, 2015 was a really tough year. I mean, there were so many shootings involving officers, and that's really caused a lot of people to question the training that they receive, the use of force, and how we should really look at that, and how we should maybe think about changing some of these policies.
which is happening today as it happens. Part of the reason why we're doing a pre-record today, ladies and gentlemen, is because the Rules Committee is having a special hearing today at the behest of activists, I think, right?
I think so, yeah.
To talk about this exact issue of how to train police officers, what should be done in cases where use of force is authorized, what should the reaction be. So, you know, what do you think people are hoping for?
I think just to really kind of look at where we're going wrong, you know, because I think, like I said, it's just been a little out of hand, very much out of hand. You know, we've lost a lot of young men this year. And I think, you know, there's been some proposals on the table. I think Police Chief Sir said that, you know, tasers were an option and the community really kind of rallied against that. So I think it's just looking at other options. Training is one of them, you know, de-escalation tactics, mm-hmm. those kind of things.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about tasers because I do find that when I go to these protests sometimes, or in general when I talk to people about police shootings, often when I ask them about potential solutions that they can think of, the first thing they say is they should have tasers. Which is interesting because, you know, first of all, a lot of people don't know that SFPD officers aren't actually allowed to have tasers. And second, I guess, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the reasoning behind disallowing them from having tasers as an alternative is that they don't statistically lower the chance of somebody actually dying in a confrontation with police a lot. Is that about right?
That sounds right to me.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it definitely, you know, it's just really how police approach a situation mm-hmm. like that, you know, when there's a call and people, you know, there's a threat, whether there's a gun involved, a weapon or something else, you know, I think it's just really not being trigger happy in that sense, you know, kind of approaching the situation in a different way. That's kind of the issue here.
Yeah. And there's been a lot of pushback at the meetings that I've been at where this is discussed from the Police Officers Association, where many officers come out and say, look, in a situation like this, what happens is that your adrenaline surges and you basically get tunnel vision and there's like you're afraid for your life and you're going to do anything it takes not to die. And for them, you know, in some case that means using lethal force. And I just wonder if there's a way to reconcile those two sides, because on, you know, on one hand, so basically nobody wants anybody to die. In an ideal world, nobody dies. Everybody goes home at the end of the day, or in the case of a violent perpetrator, goes to jail and is brought to justice.
Right.
That would be the ultimate goal, right? So I sort of, you know, I wonder about if there's going to be a resolution here, or if people just are too raw and emotional right now. I mean, it's an emotional thing that's happening to the families whose kids have been shot.
I think there's so many kind of layers involved too. You know, I think it's on one hand, it's what we're talking about right now, mm-hmm. kind of looking at the training and what different options are available and how we can change, you know, the way these officers react in those situations. But then there's also issues of how the city and how the police force handles these situations after a shooting occurs.
Right.
So I think that's also part of the whole conversation right now. You know, we saw that with Mario Woods. I'm not quite sure on the timeline here, but, you know, the mayor taking a while to apologize to the mom. That's a big demand that the activist, the family has of the city, is take responsibility to some extent and at least apologize, you know? And I think that's part of the conversation. Some other things that are on the table, too, are, what are the policies regarding notifying a family member of, you know, a death when police shooting? And that's been an issue as well. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of things that I think are being looked at right now that kind of go hand in hand.
Yeah, the other, you know, thing worth mentioning here is that, I mean, of course, this was widely reported, so maybe this is old news, but the night that Mario Woods was shot, the police commission was meeting to discuss whether or not police officers should be able to view footage from their body cams that are going to be rolled out soon before making a report about the incident. And, you know, they ultimately ruled sort of with exceptions that, yes, they can view the footage. I mean, the official decision, if I remember correctly, was that they can't except under certain circumstances, and those certain circumstances include a superior officer or the chief allows it.
Right.
And you know, the
logic behind that, and you I feel like you know this better than I do, but the logic behind that was to kind of help the officers write their police reports, right? Yeah. That's mm-hmm. the reason.
To write the reports as accurately as possible. Mm-hmm. And I think that they also, you know, officers are feeling pretty targeted by people who say, you know, you're just going to lie about it.
Right.
So we have to get the footage first so we can catch you in that lie. And you know, they called it a gotcha kind of rule. Mm-hmm. And they worry, I think. I mean, I would be worried too if I had to remember a high stress situation off the top of my head, write a report, and then it turns out that's not what happened at all. We've actually seen that, right?
We had this conversation the other mm-hmm, day.
In a case where there was a police shooting, police officers shot a man who had pulled out a, it turned out to be fake weapon, a fake gun, at the Mission Police Station parking lot, and he had been by the day before and asked officers, what would you do if someone came here with a gun? And he had been told he's not allowed to be there, and it would have serious consequences, I think, if you know, if he came back with a firearm. And mm-hmm. and then later it came to light that there apparently a suicide note was unearthed, and that he had intended to provoke the officers. You know, at least this is what the officers say. So
I can only imagine how stressful it is, you know, to be in a situation like that. And I'm sure that sometimes the story doesn't line up, or, you know, one person saw one thing, another person saw another thing, and that's how it goes.
Well, that is exactly what happened, mm-hmm. is somebody that we at Mission Local actually trusted quite a bit, a former Mission Local editor, had been there
right.
and sort of witnessed it.
And that's a reporter.
Thought that she had seen, or at least heard, the victim in the end fire a weapon.
Wow.
And it turned out that could not have possibly have happened because it was a BB gun.
Right.
I mean, I guess in that situation, maybe you mistake the firing of a BB gun for a real firearm, or you don't know what an actual gun firing sounds like.
Right.
She heard the officers fire and confused it one for the other. Anyway, so in that sort of situation, you know, it's certainly clear that immediate witness recollections have problems, and studies have shown this too. I mean, they're not only often inaccurate or maybe just fuzzy, but mm-hmm. also totally malleable, so they can change dramatically depending
Absolutely.
On suggestion. So I think that was definitely one of the concerns at this hearing about whether or not officers can look at their footage before writing a report. And I imagine that will continue to be a topic, right?
I mean, that definitely seems like it will be. And I think, you know, I think the big thing is kind of transparency right now, you know, and I think there's so much mistrust in the community, just with everything that we've seen this past year and before.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that will be definitely a hot issue, and to see how that kind of rolls out with the body cameras.
Do you think an independent investigation will happen?
As in both cases, in Nieto and Mario Woods' case?
In Mario Woods' case, yeah.
You know, I think, who's to say, but I think the way that the community is rallying behind Mario Woods and the family, you know, and I think they have a lot of momentum. I think that Alex Nieto kind of set the stage a lot, so it's possible.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess we'll see, and we'll see what transpires today at the hearings, at the various hearings on all these topics.
Don't forget to read about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Read about it on missionlocal.org. You can also see that video produced by activists about the Alex Nieto case online. Since they released it for free, you can see it on our site, or you can go to YouTube and search for Lowrider Lawyers, and of course all previous coverage of police shootings in the Mission District on our site as well. And I think we're going to have to leave it there. So after us, stick around for John Digital, bringing you electronic tunes and indie music and more from across the pond. If you know something that we don't that you think we should, shoot us an email at info@missionlocal.com. We'll be back 2 weeks from now. Thanks for listening.